You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 22nd of August 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, how to unite the European Union. Head of the EU Leaders Summit in Bratislava, Angela Merkel, Matteo Renzi and François Hollande meet to find out the best ways of relaunching the European project. My guests, Isabel Hilton and William Patey, will give us their take on this and the day's other top stories, including Turkey is devastated by yet another suicide attack. What impact will it have on the crackdown post-attempted coup? Plus, Brexit has prompted a rush to foreign embassies, but not all of them are European. Then, we level up to the Rio Olympics closing ceremony and discuss that cameo by Shinzo Abe as Super Mario. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are William Patey and Isabel Hilton. William Patey is an international affairs advisor at Control Risks and a former British ambassador to Sudan, Iraq, Saudi Arabia and Afghanistan. And Isabel Hilton is the editor of the China Dialogue. Welcome both to Midori House. Now, we start today's programme just off the coast of Naples on the island of Ventotene, where the leaders of Germany, Italy and France are meeting to discuss how to keep the European project together. William, do you think they'll find a way to keep the European project together? It's quite a big task, it seems.
Well, I'm sure they'll muddle through in some way. The trouble is that I don't think there's much consensus on what the future of the European project is, even amongst that elite group of Merkel, Hollande and Renzi, and which of them will be there in 2017. So there's a whole divergence of view on Europe. So I'm sure they'll want to coordinate and try and stabilise the ship with all the instability that the Brexit has produced. But you see Juncker coming out with a completely different vision of an ever closer union, and I'm just not sure that's saleable to the people of Europe at the moment.
And it's an important point you raise there, William, because, you know, that's, I guess, why the Brexit button in part hasn't been pushed here in the UK, apart from the fact that they don't know what will happen once they do it, but because they don't know who they're going to be dealing with. And so they're kind of perhaps waiting to see what the election results are in Germany and France. But you have, as you say, three leaders here, two of whom could be gone quite soon.
And you've also got the threat of referenda in other European countries. I mean, imagine if the Dutch hold a referendum and opt for the British route. Then you're in a way, you could be in a much bigger negotiation about, which I've always thought was on the cards and supported why I was a Remainer, was because we had a two-tier Europe. You had a group of countries who wanted closer integration, and you had a wider group, of which Britain was the leading exponent, of a much looser arrangement, wanted to be part of a single market, but also wanted to be governing its own affairs. So we could be in the throes of a much bigger revolution in Europe.
Isabel, that kind of key question, you when you look at it outside, you know, the notion of ever closer union, it has become a bit of a threat to the residents of many countries. Do you think the European Union has just been very bad at explaining what it means by that, and in part has been tripped up because Juncker is so... You know, he's so capable of annoying people in lots of different capitals. He's not very good at doing the PR for why we should help each other share ideas. That should be the debate rather than this notion that you're going to be losing something.
Well, I think his bigger problem is that he's been rather ineffective at what he's meant to be doing, which is spending an awful lot of money investing in Europe to deal with things like, you know, the 30% plus youth unemployment problem in, for instance, Italy. So, you know, he certainly does annoy people. But if the core group is going to convince Europeans that the European Union does have a better future, then he's going to have to be a little bit more effective. But I agree with William that, you know, all of these leaders are facing domestic problems which are related to the but not caused by Brexit. So, you know, the Italian constitutional referendum, the threat that all the right-wing nationalist parties in each of these countries could pursue that line themselves is very much on their minds. What the problem is, again, I agree with William, is that they don't have a single way forward. They're each managing crises at home, and it's very hard to see a single way forward. To go back to a two-speed Europe essentially means reversing Maastricht. I mean, ever closer union is, as you know, built into the Treaty of Rome, but Maastricht was a later addition. And pre-Maastricht, you did have very much a structure of a two-track Europe, because you had the wider circle, you had the core group, and it kind of rubbed along. And maybe as we look back on what went wrong, obviously the single currency was a step too far, having currency union before you have political union. But maybe Maastricht in the end just was what imposed those strains which have not been resolved.
And do you think this tension, you know, we know that Angela Merkel has said that she doesn't feel this is the time to be pushing that ever notion of ever closer union. But do you think that that was a mistake in the end? Because I think that most people, well, not most people, in many countries, people do now see this as some kind of threat to a loss of national identity. And while they might have been happier to kind of, you know, have a kind of, you know, a metric system that was unified or trading systems that were unified, over time they've got a resistance to the idea that they're going to lose some of their identity. And in a way, that's the failure of the EU. It's not very good at explaining how you can kind of do one, but it doesn't mean that you're going to lose your what you mean as a nation.
I think that that could be overcome, because actually there are identities which are stronger in a you know, the multinational or transnational context of the European Union than they are within a nation state that tries to suppress them. So, you know, you see that in Scotland, in Ireland, and you know, even the Catalans, you know, where you have a very strong centralized state, you know, other identities don't flourish. Whereas in Europe, it's much more of a kind of patchwork. You know, the nation state as the dominant entity is qualified. So other identities can emerge. You know, we're not all living in the 19th century with the notion of the nation state as our only way of being. And I think that could have been overcome. I do think, though, that the euro, you know, this notion that you can run a European economy, which is what a single currency does entail when you don't have a political or effectively an economic union of that nature, I think is not resolvable.
William, as someone who looks at the security side of this equation, one of the things that seems clear is they do believe there is room for greater integration around, you know, threats of terrorism and even militarily as well. And again, that's one of the things which causes some nations to pause. Do you think those elements are a kind of clearer path for the more powerful nations that will be remaining within the EU?
Well, I think, you know, they're going to be under pressure from the US, not related to EU, but related to NATO, for their contribution to NATO. If, you know, Donald Trump has already, you know, raised the idea that other NATO nations are not contributing enough, and that might condition the United States' commitment to them. Now, even if Donald Trump doesn't get in, that feeling will be left with Congress that the Germans and others may have to contribute more. But I think the UK has always, outside the structures of the European Union, had very close cooperation with France, and happy to have so with Germany. And I think the UK, whatever happens over Brexit, the UK will want to be very close to France and Germany in the defence and security field, notwithstanding its Five Eyes intelligence alliance with old Commonwealth in the US. So I think those issues are very important to both. And I think that whatever happens in the Brexit negotiations, close cooperation on security, Interpol, and will be an absolute priority for all of them.
And just finally, Isabel, on this, you know, interesting for Renzi, you know, the location has been highlighted a lot today, that this island is where several Italian intellectuals met very early on, that kind of gave some of the genesis for the actual formation of the EU. Do you think that Renzi, you know, in a way, post, you know, potentially Britain leaving the European Union, well, almost definitely leaving the European Union, he sees a chance here to kind of push forward an Italian perspective, to be a bit more dominant within in the European Union, to own even the creation of the European Union a little bit more.
Well, I certainly don't think it's a coincidence that they're meeting there. And actually, I'm sympathetic to remembering why the European Union came into being in the first place. I mean, there they were in prison, you know, suffering from fascism in the middle of Europe's catastrophic war. And that's quite a good thing to remember, that I personally feel the European Union has had a consistently bad press all its life. But it, and we forget what an extraordinary enterprise it remains. Now, Italy is currently one of the problem children of Europe. It's got a banking crisis. It's in all kinds of trouble. So, yes, I think the opportunity to, you know, remind people that that Italy was among the kind of progenitors of the idea is appealing to Renzi.
Well, we're going to move on now. We're going to head to Turkey, where more than 50 people were killed and at least 69 wounded at the weekend. A suicide bomber, believed to be no more than 14 years old, was to blame for the attack. And a lot of the victims seem to have been children too. William, back to you on this. You know, what's interesting, you know, that ISIS, I guess, are being dislodged from many towns in Syria. They're under attack in Iraq. Are we seeing a very concerted effort here to change their policy of terror and really target Turkey in a more kind of logical, consistent way? Because Turkey does seem to be bearing the brunt now of many ISIS attacks.
Well, I doubt we're going to see consistency here. I think Turkey has certainly been an opponent of ISIS, but it's been almost one of its lower priorities. So it's surprising that ISIS feel the need to attack Turkey, because Turkey has been, as we've seen even recently, even since the attack, the Turks have been bombarding Kurds in Syria, who have been the most effective group against ISIS, so-called ISIS, and have been allied with the Americans. So you're getting sucked up into an incredible degree of complexity here. And one of the ironies here is that the target was of the Kurdish party, the HDP, who Erdogan tried to reach out to in earlier times. So everything has been turned upside down in Turkey. There's no consistent pattern. You've got Turkey with a multitude of aims, defeating ISIS being probably not the top one, getting rid of Assad and making sure that the Kurds of Syria do not have a contiguous area running all the way along the Turkish border. So their priorities are different. And so although they'll respond to this ISIS attack, it still won't change their overall strategy and priorities.
It's interesting that, you know, we think of the Kurds as being, you know, reasonably secular in the way that they operate and how they run their territory and how they fight. And here we have like two increasingly Muslim forces in a very different way, of course, ISIS and also the Turkish government, which is increasingly proud of its using faith in its politics. Do you think they both see the Kurds as a common enemy, therefore, because they are more secular in how they do things?
Well, the Kurds are a common enemy. They may not approach that. I mean, I think that Erdogan and ISIS may have different reasons for regarding them as an enemy, but they certainly both do. And I think Erdogan's problem is that he has an awful lot of enemies at this point and has said that he regards, you know, the Kurds and ISIS and the people allegedly involved in the coup or sympathetic to those involved in the coup as the same. Now, that's an awful lot of people. That's an awful lot of enemies. But it's undoubtedly true that for the Turkish state, the Kurds are the priority. Now, that's not about religion so much. It's about the integrity of the Kurdish state, which Turkey has always been extraordinarily fierce in defence of, and pretty unyielding in terms of any concessions to the Kurds. That's not going to change.
William, can I ask you a question about your previous life? You were ambassador to some of the toughest countries in the world, which have been through very similar kind of ructions to what's happening in Syria and on the edges of Turkey now. If you were a diplomat involved in this now, sending back cables to London, would you see any opportunity, any hope? We see that the Americans doing some kind of low-level kind of backing of the opposition finally, but in the way giving Russia the upper hand. How would you attempt to translate this for an audience back in government, back in London, if you were trying to encourage them to do something, anything?
Well, I think your problem would be that it's very hard to see a way through in previous places where I've been, Sudan, Iraq, Afghanistan. There has been a core of a state, there has been a regime you could support against its enemies, and they're still there. And effectively, the governments that were established in Afghanistan and Iraq, and even in Sudan, although that they're all collapsing, a sort of litany of failure. As I think about it, it's not all my fault, honestly. But you
go back and forth that, yeah.
It was all right when I left, is the title of my book. But you get in Syria, you had I think the moment for supporting Assad. I mean, 2 years ago, I rather controversially said we might have to come and do a deal with Assad, the devil, and that might be the way to save Syria, because we clearly have not invested enough in the opposition, the acceptable opposition, that would enable them to overthrow Assad. So now we've got the only effective opposition to Assad is ISIS or other Islamist elements with a very weak, what you call moderate Democrats. So they've got no chance of overthrowing Assad. And now you're left with, even if Assad was to prevail, what sort of state would he be in charge of? So I'm afraid we're just going to have to do the best, take the best option at each stage, and then hope for the best. And the best option at this stage is to concentrate on beating Daesh and so-called Islamic State, because they threaten not only Syria, they threaten Turkey, and they threaten Iraq. So defeating Daesh is a credible objective. And I would almost say that prolonging the civil war in Syria by continuing to support anti-Assad elements will prolong it. It's a horrible conclusion to come to, but actually, letting the Russians and the Iranians win in this instance may be the least bad option. But I know that's not where we'll go.
Isabel, realpolitik. What do you, when you hear that as a diplomat's explanation of what, potentially what will happen, that the British government should not be offering any support. They should allow this to come to probably a brutal but a swifter conclusion.
It's extremely unpalatable, but I have heard very few good ideas for this situation. To cling to ineffective policies maybe yet be a worse option. That is a pretty depressing conclusion. And I think one of the complications is that everybody has a different priority in this. It's clear from the Russian pattern of bombardment that it's the Syrian opposition that are, Syria's and Russia's prime targets, not Daesh or ISIS. On the other hand, the Americans, the Brits and the West wants to defeat ISIS. Turkey wants to defeat the Kurds. It's a war of all against all in many ways. And nature, I'm afraid, will take its course. There is very little that we could do to intervene at this point to change the result, is my feeling. So reluctantly, I think that that's probably the way it's going to go.
Well, William Patey and Isabel Hilton, thank you for now. You're listening to Midori House, but when we come back, the rush to foreign embassies post-Brexit.
How much information can you pack into a minute? Every morning, the Monocle Minute wings its way into your inbox, packed with the very latest news and views from around the world, all delivered with a monocle twist. We'll tell you what that new aircraft carrier means for Southeast Asia, why the next EU summit will be more interesting than normal, and what to look out for at an upcoming election. We'll pick out the latest retail trend in Latin America, analyse the aviation news in Australia, and take a tour of a neighbourhood that's on the up. And there's more. At the weekend, we'll review the best new restaurants, give you the lowdown on that art exhibition you've been meaning to visit, and dissect the best of the latest fashion week. See? There's rather a lot you can pack into a minute. Sign up now at monocle.com/minute.
Well, welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, William Patey and Isabel Hilton. Now, following the Brexit vote, there seems to have been a bit of a rush to many of the embassies based here in London as citizens of the UK try to find out whether they have any links to other nations trying to secure a passport. Now, some people obviously are trying to get passports to other EU nations so they can kind of remain within the EU, even if they're within the UK. And Finland, for example, has said it had 100 passport applications, more than the previous summer. It doesn't sound like a huge amount, but I don't know how many people are normally moving to Finland. And meanwhile, New Zealand has had a bit of a rush. And even the local papers have said, be warned, there may be a British invasion as 10,000 British nationals have registered their interest in moving to or working in or investing in the nation. Isabel, now, as someone who knows quite a lot of people who are doing this, you know, I have a very good Scottish friend whose mother was French. It never meant anything to her. But as a security thing, she has now got the passport, suddenly digging up their nationalities. And somebody else I know is at this moment waiting for their Irish passport to arrive. They've done the application. Again, father born in Ireland, never really thought about it much. Do you think this is going to be a significant thing? And do you think it's only going to be a middle class thing? Because I wonder how many regular people are thinking about this. It's people who feel that they can kind of work anywhere, move anywhere.
Well, there are an awful lot of working class Irish in Britain, so I wouldn't think it's entirely a middle class thing. My own well-documented Irish grandfather, whom sadly I never met, is going to be pressed into service and on my own account when I get around to filling in the forms. There was a bit of a rush on at the Irish embassy when I did inquire, so I thought, well, I'll wait till it dies down. I think that certainly for me, I voted the other way. I voted Remain, and I still feel personally very bruised by this. I think it's a bad decision. And I think that, you know, on a personal level, I still don't feel ready to, you know, swing along with the exit. So I shall certainly be applying for an Irish passport.
Well, I mean, it's interesting in light of the conversation we had at the beginning of this about, you know, what the EU means. And, you know, from a distance, for many people, it looks just like some kind of, you know, annoying talking club. But actually, when it comes down to it, people like this freedom of movement for themselves, you know, and they are willing to kind of, you know, do lots to kind of maintain it. Are you surprised at the numbers of people who are thinking about whether the UK is for them post the vote?
Well, I think it's entirely understandable that anyone with access to a different European passport would want to exercise it. I'm old enough to remember when we didn't have a border-free Europe you had to travelling in trains from France to Italy, wait, the trains stop in the middle of the night and the Italian security guards come, the immigration officials come on to check your passports. I never want to go back to that time. I love the freedom, and my children love that freedom. I personally, the only access I would have to a European passport is if Scotland became independent. So I have no other means. I'm afraid I'm stuck with my British nationality exclusively. But I would certainly be on the side of people who, whatever happens with Brexit, I don't think we will go to we will have a visa-free system. I'm pretty confident that Europeans will be able to travel to Britain without visas, and we will be able to travel to Europe without visas. So in that sense, freedom of movement will still be
not the right to work.
Not the right to live.
No, exactly. And I think that's what, you know, even if you don't use it, I think that's the thing that many British people who voted to Remain feel robbed of. They feel robbed of the possibility. That's what life is exciting, is when you think you have options, even if you don't cash them in.
Well, I think that's right. And if you could take it, you will. But I mean, I was arguing with an old friend who was ambassador with me in Afghanistan. He's now the EU ambassador to Moscow, a former Lithuanian foreign minister. And I was saying to him, look, Europe needs to look at Britain, needs to treat Britain with kid gloves. And I do think there's still a possibility of access to the single market with freedom of labour. when Juncker talks about the four freedoms, he talks about people, goods, services, and capital. Well, we've never had absolute freedom in services. Why can't we have conditional freedom on people? Because you could have freedom of movement of labour plus tourism. So if you could, if you had a job in Britain, I don't see why we couldn't have freedom of labour. So with a bit of flexibility on both sides, I think we can square the Brexit circle. I'm not convinced that we will leave. I think we'll stay on different terms somehow.
It's curious in that context, though, that the City of London, which has most to lose, if you like, from this, given passporting rights and so on, has concluded that it can't have a Norwegian deal because of the very question of freedom of movement. So I think this comes down to the political signals at home, that and this is completely unknown and unknowable. We really don't know how this will play out here, and what will finally be acceptable and what will be put back to the people to say, here is a set of unpalatable choices. Which one do you want? And, which I think, in all honesty, they ought to do.
Yeah, you know, as a Remainer, I refuse to accept that this is an irrevocable result. I voted for the European Union in 1975. That wasn't irrevocable. People campaigned for the whole of their political life to reverse it. I will continue to campaign for the reversal of this one. And I think it's entirely credible that if we go into a next election without this having been resolved, if enough people vote for parties who are opposed Brexit, that is a perfectly legitimate way to change our minds.
Well, I think we can form a support group.
I'm just looking around for the parties.
Yeah. Now, if you, unless you're Isabel Hilton, you probably know that last night was the final night of the Olympics, and the closing ceremony saw a rather mighty display of soft power, particularly in the handing over to Tokyo ahead of the 2020 Games. Several nods to Japanese pop culture appeared, including Hello Kitty, Doraemon, and even a special guest, a Super Mario. Well, it may not have been that clear, but that was actually Shinzo Abe, the Prime Minister of Japan, appearing dressed as Super Mario. William, we're going to have to start with someone who's actually watched some of this thing. Did you think this was a good moment for Brazil?
Oh, yes. I mean, I think in the end, Brazil have gone through tremendous problems. There was all sorts of doomsday scenarios. Nobody would turn up because of the Zika virus, that nothing would be ready. Brazil's crime would get the better. In the end, they've delivered a perfectly good Olympics at a more modest scale than other countries have. And I think, you know, the backdrop of Rio de Janeiro, I was there in January. I wanted to get there before the Olympics in case the Olympics spoilt it. But it was a fantastic backdrop. So I think the Brazilians, you know, have come away pretty credibly. And I would just say all credit to Shinzo Abe. I mean, Japanese prime ministers are not known for their sort of sense of humour and reaching out to the public. I mean, it didn't come off as well as it might have done with his costume disrobing earlier than normal. But all credit to him for willingness to take part.
Yeah, I think he had some of the kind of the gung-ho spirit of our current foreign secretary. Isabel, what have you been doing? Why?
Life is rich. You don't have to sit in front of a television set watching sport. I don't mind other people doing it if that's okay. If that works for you. It just doesn't really move me. You know, I'm interested in the politics of the Olympics, but actually the event itself doesn't really do it for me. And I want to speak up for all the people who really don't like watching sport, because we are an oppressed, probably a majority.
So you've had a few restaurants to yourself, a few kind of
absolutely. There's just this irritating roar you hear from time to time, but you know, you can learn to live with that.
And you wonder what to put that down to. Ahead of Tokyo, do you think it's going to be good for Japan as well? Because the interesting thing about the Brazilians, they did get behind it, and they're very kind of relaxed about things. Well, it'll be interesting to see. Japan will be super efficient, organised, but do you think it'll be a good moment for Japan as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think Japan's gone through decades of kind of stagnation, really, hasn't. So it is an opportunity for them. I think they'll do it well, very well organised. And actually, I think the Japanese will probably fill the stadia, which is slightly different from Rio, empty seats. So I think it'll be, I think it'll be a good Olympics. Its only problem is it's the wrong time zone. I don't know why we can't have Olympics in our time zone. So I'm all for Paris or South Africa or anyone down the Greenwich Mean Line. I prefer to watch my sport not at 2 a.m. in the morning.
I'm all for moving it back to Greece on a permanent basis. Okay. It would cut the bribery, it would cut the nonsense, and it would be in your time zone.
It's a reasonable time. I think we can agree on that.
And you'd get a tan. Well, William Beatty and Isabel Hilton, two gold medal performances there. Thank you very much for joining us. That's all we have time for on today's show. It was produced by Carlo Trebello, researched by Fernanda Augusto Pacheco. But from me, Andrew Tuck, goodbye.